Welcome to EI Talks. I'm Angus Riley, Assistant Editor at Engelsberg Ideas. Today I'm broadcasting from the Engelsberg Seminar, a global gathering of academics and policymakers in Sweden. My guest is William Inboden. Inboden is a professor and director of the Hamilton Center for Classical and Civic Education at the University of Florida. He is also the author of The Peacemaker, Ronald Reagan, the Cold War, and The World on the Brink, which we'll be discussing today. By the time of Reagan's election in 1980, the Cold War has changed. It's very different to how it was when it began 35 years ago. How did Ronald Reagan perceive those changes?
Yeah, Reagan was in a lot of ways quite critical of the changes that had taken place in the Cold War over the previous decade, really, primarily because he thought that they were to the advantage of the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc, and to the disadvantage of the United States and the free world. So to recap, when he is elected as president and sworn in, it was just about 8 years after the United States had withdrawn in disgrace and defeat from Vietnam. Okay, so it's America's first lost war in our country's history. And even though Vietnam was complicated and in a lot of ways was a civil war between North and South Vietnam, it was also a Cold War war, right? And so this was seen as the first military victory by communist forces over American forces on the battlefield. And then over the several succeeding years, the Soviet-sponsored communism had had a number of advances across the global south, right? So Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Angola, Nicaragua, Afghanistan, South Yemen had all fallen to communism. And I say fallen because none of those countries had communist governments come to power through peaceful, open, free, and fair elections. It had all been through armed revolution. Again, there's complicating factors in each one. But in the big global chessboard, one can see advantages accruing more to the Soviet side and losses to the non-communist bloc. And then, of course, on bilateral U.S.-Soviet relations themselves, the previous three presidents, Nixon, Ford, and Carter, as different as they were, had all adopted more or less a similar détente framework between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Détente was designed to lessen tensions between the superpowers, not pretend that all the differences will go away, but to lessen tensions, to look for areas of cooperation and to have more managed competition. And there was some wisdom in the détente policy when Nixon and Kissinger first developed it, right? Again, we can have me on another time. We'll do a more lengthy discourse on détente. But for Reagan's purposes, and I think that there's some wisdom in his critique there. What had started as a temporary tactical expediency of let's lessen tensions between the U.S. and the Soviet Union through détente had turned into a more permanent state of affairs where the United States was kind of committed to the stalemate or losing as slowly as possible in the Cold War and had more or less accepted the Soviet Union as a permanent fixture on the geopolitical landscape. And Reagan rejected that. And so that was one of the many things that he wanted to reverse in the Cold War when he took office.
And in your book, you say that when he enters office, the first pillar of his foreign policy is restoring the American economy.
Yes.
And how does that figure into the narrative of the Cold War?
Oh, it's fundamental on multiple levels, but I'll just highlight two. First, on the operational level, Reagan is committed to a substantial military buildup, right? Substantial increases in the American defense budget. Well, you can't pay for that if your economy is in recession. And then you're not going to get the political will, the American people willing to pay for it if so many of them are unemployed and feeling despondent about their futures. And so he knew that his credibility as president as well as the resource base that he needed to wage the Cold War depended on restoring the American economy. And again, the U.S. economy was in a multi-year recession at that point. We had this awful phenomenon of stagflation, which is high unemployment and high inflation, and it just seemed impossible to get out. The second level of Reagan's commitment to restoring the American economy is because he conceived of the Cold War as a battle of ideas, and he wanted to show the superiority of market economies, of the free enterprise system, to command economies and to government control of the economy, as you saw in the Soviet bloc. If he was going to wage and win that battle of ideas, he needed to show that the American, the free world system of market economies worked better, and that depended on delivering economic results for the people and growing the economy again.
Also, the other side of this period is related to oil and the aftermath of the 73 oil shock and 79 as well. But then the Soviet Union also has its own, is exploiting its own oil reserves to,
surge ahead.
Yeah, the energy dimension is really important here too. And again, on the different ways you talked about there. I mean, so first, you know, for the previous, you know, 7-8 years, the United States had been in its own energy crisis where we were not producing enough domestic oil and gas, you know, from our then known reserves. And so we were very dependent on importing oil from primarily the Middle East, but really from abroad. But then when OPEC had imposed the oil embargo after the 73 war, it had been a real humiliation for the United States. Sure, it hurt our economy and hurt our livelihoods, but also just made the United States appear impotent, like this crippled giant. And, you know, there's still, one can find on Google, these iconic photos of the 1970s of showing the automobile lines at gasoline stations, at filling stations, which would stretch for hours. Like, people couldn't even fill up their own cars. And so when you can't literally fuel your own car, you can't metaphorically fuel the American economy. And so there was the geopolitical as well as the economic aspect. And meanwhile, as you mentioned, the Soviet Union is one of the world's largest oil and gas producers and was starting to deepen its oil and gas exports, especially to Western European countries. And so the United States also sees a real geopolitical vulnerability there because of the West's dependence on Soviet oil and gas.
Yeah, despite all of these difficulties facing the United States, Reagan has quite a simple conception of Cold War strategy for the United States, as in, he says to an aide, his vision for it is, we win, they lose.
Yes.
And that really runs against the general thoughts and views of policymakers in the era of détente, and it really stands out.
Yeah, this was where Reagan was really, I think, a visionary and was challenging the conventional wisdom, the strategic consensus of the time. And we win, they lose, it's a classic Reagan comment because it's a little jingoistic, right? It's punchy, you know, it has a certain emotive appeal. It's only four monosyllabic words, we win, they lose. And yet, to consider it in the context of what he meant and the, you know, prevailing attitude of the time, I think that there's much more strategic profundity to that, right? So let's take it apart. We win. There was actually a belief that it would be possible for the United States and the free world to prevail, to emerge victorious from this conflict. Nobody thought that at the time. You know, the prevailing view among, you know, most Republicans and Democrats, among every previous American president, was that the Cold War was a competition to be managed rather than a conflict that could actually be won, okay? And then they lose. The assumption underneath that is that it was possible to envision a world where the Soviet Union no longer existed, that the Soviet Union could actually be defeated. And in hindsight, we can see that that's what happens, but very few people saw that at the time, even though, you know, some Western analysts were beginning to have some awareness about some slowdown in the Soviet economy. It's a very different thing altogether to translate an understanding of a slowdown or inefficiencies in the Soviet economy to a belief that this entire empire, if you will, could dissolve. Yeah. So Reagan brings a very different strategic theory of the case on the possibilities in the Cold War into the Oval Office. One other point I should make, though, is because the we win, they lose part emphasizes the more aggressive or assertive parts of Reagan's strategy, and that's certainly there, right, the pressure. But he was also very committed to keeping the Cold War cold, meaning he was terrified of nuclear war. He was a nuclear abolitionist. He didn't want the Cold War to turn into a hot war. And at another point during the presidential campaign, he'd also been asked about it by an aide, why are you running for president? And he said, because I want to end the Cold War. And so he was always committed to a peaceful victory in the Cold War. And that peaceful part really needs to be emphasized, which is why from early on in his administration, he is pursuing diplomacy and negotiations and outreach with the Soviets in tandem with that pressure campaign. And so we need to understand both those parts of his strategy if he wants to win and end the Cold War. And that sounds nice as a talking point, but it's actually very difficult to pull off in practice.
Reagan's foreign policy is often viewed as a play in two acts of the first administration, 80-84. It's very muscular. It's very aggressive. But there are moments of true crisis where it suddenly seems like they're coming too close to the brink. And then he's re-elected in 1984 and finds a common partner in Gorbachev. Yeah. Do you agree with that framing?
Not quite. It's not altogether wrong, but it's known primarily as the Reagan reversal thesis or the two Reagan thesis, right? Which is that in the first term, he's more belligerent and hawkish and confrontational. And then in the second term, he becomes more peaceful and conciliatory. I rather see that fundamentally, there's more continuity than change in Reagan's approach. And the continuity has two strands. There is the pressure strand, the confrontation strand throughout his 8 years as president, and we can talk about how he keeps that up in the second term. But also throughout his 8 years, there is the diplomacy and the outreach. Yep. Now, there are some adjustments that he makes along the way. And of course, the biggest one comes in March of 85 when the Soviet Union, the Politburo selects Mikhail Gorbachev as his new Soviet leader. And Reagan now finally has a negotiating partner, a Soviet leader willing to meet with him and to pursue a reform agenda. So interesting, I will say, is Beth Fisher, the great scholar at University of Toronto, is the one who first came up with the Reagan reversal thesis back in the 1990s. And she did it doing careful, judicious scholarship based on the available sources at the time. She has more recently reversed herself as well. And I'd say this is a compliment to her. I think there's great scholarly integrity in this. But she has now said that now that we more archives have been declassified, now that we have more of a window into Reagan's thinking, she sees more genuine outreach on his part in the first term and more consistency rather than reversal across his two terms.
So what incidents and what evidence have shown scholars like her and yourself that to be the case?
So part of it is even in 1981, Reagan's very first year in office, when he does a number of confrontational attacks towards the Soviets, he's also engaging in outreach. So right after he nearly dies in the assassination attempt in March of 1981, as he's still recovering from this near-death experience, he writes a couple of letters to Soviet Premier Brezhnev saying, "We want peace. I want to sit down with you. Can we negotiate? Can we find a way out of this awful Cold War? Our nations share more in common than the differences that divide us. Our people don't want war." Very conciliatory outreach. And then also in his first year, he lifts the grain embargo that had been imposed by Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. So after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, Carter said, okay, the United States will not sell any more grain to the Soviet Union. Soviets needed to import grain because they couldn't feed their own people. Reagan lifts that embargo. He knows that American farmers want to be able to sell their goods to the Soviets, but he also does it as an outreach gesture to the Soviets, saying, look, even though I don't like Soviet communism as a system, the Russian people are not our enemies. We want the Russian people to be able to be fed. We want to look for measures of goodwill and conciliation and showing that we don't have those hostile intentions of trying to invade or start a war with the Soviets. So we now know, and I think Beth and others have looked more carefully, that we see a number of these more conciliatory gestures that Reagan makes towards the Soviets in the first term, even while he's also doing the more confrontational pressure ones. Yeah. And it's there's just those two prongs throughout his 8 years.
I mean, quite uniquely in comparison to his predecessors, he seems quite an emotive president. He really thinks about the possibility of nuclear war, what it would mean. And for him, it's religious as well. Mm-hmm. He thinks about the alternative a lot.
Yes. Yeah. This is where Reagan, you're right, emotive, another word I've used before is intuitive. Okay. So again, Reagan, even though he sees the Cold War as a battle of ideas, as I said before, he's not an intellectual, right? He doesn't have a PhD. He's not a real conceptual strategist in the way of, say, a Henry Kissinger, even maybe a Richard Nixon. But Reagan, he combines certain principles, a commitment to markets, a hatred of totalitarianism and communism, with intuitions about both what are the lived experiences of this conflict for ordinary people behind the Iron Curtain, right? That's why he's very enamored of the plight of dissidents, of Jewish refuseniks. But also, he tries to put himself in the shoes of his Soviet counterparts. He's often trying to ask himself, what does the world look like if you're Brezhnev or later if you're Gorbachev? And he thought, they don't want to see the world destroyed in nuclear holocaust either. They want better lives for their children also. And so in that sense, there's a certain sophistication to his emotional intelligence there. When you couple that with his longstanding fear and horror of nuclear war and nuclear weapons, which goes back decades, my friend and fellow scholar Paul Leto has written a wonderful book about Reagan's nuclear abolitionism, which I commend to our listeners. That's why Reagan is very committed to the negotiations and diplomacy track with the Soviets, because he wants to reduce the risk of nuclear war and eventually rid the world entirely of the scourge of nuclear weapons. Again, going back to he just can envision the awful, awful, almost impossible to contemplate horror of the world being destroyed in nuclear war. And so for him, he would just think about that possibility for himself, for his family and others, and think, I want to avoid that. Therefore, we need to find a way out of that. And so those emotional intuitions are important for his strategic framework.
I mean, he finds a like-minded partner in Gorbachev, which is really, it's really one of the most extraordinary pairings in modern history. And you think about the Reykjavik summit in October 1986, where they come so close to pledging the abolition of nuclear weapons, but then SDI gets in the way.
Yes.
The Strategic Defense Initiative.
Yeah.
It's another example of the what if, the sort of the hypotheticals that come with Reagan, as he, he worries about the nuclear apocalypse, but then he therefore goes another way almost.
Yeah, and this is where, as none of our listeners may know, there's kind of an ongoing debate among scholars about which leader gets more credit for the peaceful end of the Cold War, Mikhail Gorbachev or Ronald Reagan. And in truth, they're both essential, okay? You can't have an iconic pairing in a partnership if you don't have both partners there, right? So they're both essential. If Reagan didn't have a Gorbachev, it wouldn't have ended the way it did. Although also I think if Gorbachev had not had a Reagan as an American counterpart, it wouldn't have as well. Now, with that, I'll be a little edgier and say I'm inclined to give Reagan a little more credit than Gorbachev, and this is where I know it's on somewhat more controversial territory, but hear me out here.
Okay.
It is because – let's think back to the chronology. Reagan takes office in January of 1981. Gorbachev doesn't come along until 4 years, 2 months later, March of 85. And we now know from declassified National Security Council transcripts and internal memos and some of Reagan's own writing that – part of Reagan's pressure strategy in that first term, before Gorbachev comes along, is to pressure the Soviet system to encourage reformist elements, to encourage it on the path of reform, and even to induce the Soviet system to produce a reformist leader with whom Reagan could negotiate. And so that's why in my book, The Peacemaker, which we're talking about here, I titled the chapter, When Gorbachev Comes to Power, Waiting for Gorbachev, because Reagan had been waiting for and looking for a Soviet leader that he could negotiate with. He hadn't had that in Brezhnev, nor Andropov, nor Chernyenko, the three predecessors, but he does find that in Gorbachev. And this is not to take anything away from Gorbachev. And, again, to be clear, Gorbachev is largely selected because of the Politburo's decision-making and internal dynamics within the Soviet system. Okay, I'm not saying that Reagan dictates that. But Reagan plays a key role in two ways. One, he does help create the conditions within which the Politburo is feeling this pressure and being more open to a more reformist leader. And second, it's the old maxim, when you're looking for something, you're more apt to find it. And because Reagan was looking for a reformist leader, he recognizes Gorbachev as a reformist leader a little earlier than a number of others do. And that's why they are able to forge that partnership. And the final part of this, this goes back to Reagan's intuition and emotional intelligence, which Gorbachev also shared, is these two guys were surprised and pleasantly so to find that they really liked each other, right? I mean, you read the transcripts, and they're all declassified and available now, of their different summit meetings with each other. Very acrimonious, very cantankerous, heated debates, shouting at each other, threatening each other, but also growing trust and real affection. And I highlight this as an example of how it is not structural forces alone that drive international politics. It is individual leaders and is the decisions those leaders make and the relationships and trust that they build with each other. And the trust that Reagan and Gorbachev build with each other enables them each to take pretty significant political risks and risks for their own countries and systems for the possibility of reducing the risk of nuclear war and bringing this conflict to a peaceful end.
I think the most extraordinary moment, the most memorable moment from your book is the incident where, and I think it's quite late, it's about 1988, where Reagan tries to convert Gorbachev to Christianity.
Yes. Yeah, this is really something. I was just blown away when I discovered this in my research. Again, our listeners can find it in the transcripts of the Reagan-Gorbachev meetings. And so, to give a little context, among other things, one of the keys to understanding Reagan is he's a man of very devout and sincere Christian faith, okay? Yes, it's idiosyncratic. It's kind of eclectic. He's an indifferent churchgoer. He tells dirty jokes. His wife is into astrology. So in that sense, he's not your standard paragon of evangelical virtue. But it's also very clear if you read his diaries, his personal letters, that this is a man who really does have a deep and sincere faith. It's not just about political opportunism, as some might think. And one of the many reasons why he so detested and loathed communism is because of its atheism, because of its state-mandated atheism, its denial of the existence of God, and its repression of individual believers. But also in Reagan's case, his faith gives him comfort. It gives him guidance. It gives him a sense of a providential hope. He quite literally is almost miraculously spared from death after the assassination attempt. He says, I think that God spared me from death so that I can reduce the risk of nuclear war and have a higher purpose of ending the Cold War here. And so when Gorbachev comes along, Reagan is always asking his aides questions like, do you think Gorbachev might actually believe in God? How can this guy be an atheist? How it's just so irrational to me. I just don't get it. And for Reagan, it's not just an intellectual puzzle. It's kind of a sense of personal grief because Reagan's faith is so important to himself. And as he's building this friendship with Gorbachev, he's thinking, it grieves me that my friend would not know the comfort, the guidance, the meaning, the redemption, frankly, that I find from my own faith. And so, you know, Reagan will drop hints throughout their different meetings, you know, mention a Bible verse or, you know, hope that Gorbachev will pick something up. But then finally, in their last summit meeting in Moscow in May of 1988, Reagan decides to lay it all out. A lengthy one-on-one conversation, he tries to persuade Gorbachev to believe in God, to become a Christian. He uses different apologetic devices. He tells stories. He even talks about his own son's atheism and how grievous that is for him. And we don't fully know what Gorbachev was thinking at the time. Now, if you read the transcripts of the meetings, Gorbachev seems, my read is, he's kind of both bemused and somewhat touched by this. No indication he actually is persuaded, right? But he doesn't get offended and say, quit imposing your religion on me, or, you know, enough of this, you know, religious superstition or anything. He hears Reagan out. He says, I'll think about this. And I think Gorbachev could tell that his friend Ronald Reagan was sharing his faith from at least a point of sincerity and goodwill and care for Gorbachev, even if they disagreed on it. And so that's, in a lot of ways, emblematic of the trust that was built between them, which enabled them to both take the political risks, such as, you know, signing the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty and other measures to bring the Cold War to a peaceful end.
So on the one hand, you have Reagan's quite effective Cold War grand strategy, engagement with the Soviet Union. But then on the other hand, as you explore in your book, because it's not just about the Cold War, you have the difficulties of his staffing, administration, organization. You have buccaneering spies and National Security Council advisors, a quite atrociously run organization in many parts that leads to an incredible scandal in the Iran-Contra
affair.
And how do you take those two quite contradictory trends in the administration together?
Yes, yes. Well, and this, I appreciate you asking that because it gives me a chance to clarify for our listeners. You know, I'm sure my listeners have picked up that, you know, my book and my assessment is overall a very favorable assessment of Reagan, especially on the Cold War. And I stand by that. I think the evidence is there. But it's by no means a hagiography, right? I mean, he was a great but flawed president who accomplished great things and also oversaw, responsible for some horrible things too. And I'll just mention a number of his personal and leadership liabilities, which then lead to a number of these, you know, true disasters, right? I mean, so first of all, he is a terrible manager. He is inattentive to detail. He's often inattentive to the details of policies, but also inattentive to the details of how the White House and the administration is run. And, you know, most listeners will know that the president is also the chief executive officer of the United States, right? That means it's a management position, right? You're in charge of running the federal government, one of the largest governments in the world. And Reagan just was very inattentive to that. And because he was averse to personal confrontation, he let his different aides squabble and feud and backbite and leak and undermine him and each other even more than most other presidencies. You know, every presidency has its divisions and rifts, but the Reagan administration did more than most. And so between that poor management, that aversion to confrontation and the inattention to detail, that creates room or opportunity for all sorts of mischief and skullduggery. And there's a number of episodes we could point to, but one of the worst is the Iran-Contra scandal, where a combination of Reagan's personal decision to sell arms to the Iranians in the hopes that they will release hostages. And this is where I think Reagan was unaware but still responsible for then the illegal diversion of those funds to fund the Contras, the anti-communist insurgents in Nicaragua. And it's a terrible scandal in the presidency. Reagan almost gets impeached over it. He repeatedly lies to the American people about it, so he breaks trust with them. He loses, you know, some of the most important quotients, which is high political capital and trust with the American people. And so it really casts a cloud over his legacy even to this day. But it also, you know, it humanizes him. I mean, it shows that I think while he was overall a great president, he certainly was not flawless, and those were among his biggest flaws.
Yes. I mean, with America's engagement with the Middle East in the 1980s, after the Iranian Revolution, you very much get a sense that they're quite overwhelmed. Like, Reagan might be the last Cold War president, but he's also sort of the first president of the War on Terror. And they struggle with that, particularly in Lebanon.
Yeah, yeah. And if, you know, if listeners do have a chance to read the book, you'll see that quite a bit of the book's time is spent on other aspects of Reagan's foreign policy outside from just U.S.-Soviet relations, right? So Asia policy, international trade policy, Middle East, terrorism, so on and so forth. And some of those policies I think he does well on. I would point to Asia in particular, and others very poorly, right? So the Middle East, he is never really able to get his mind around it. And terrorism, it's the first great era of terrorism. You know, scholars like Tim Naftali and others have written very good books on this. And Reagan can never really solve the terrorism issue. You've got the massive hostage taking. And then then because he doesn't have his own strategic vision or firm convictions on the Middle East, he would then allow some of the feuding and rifts in his own administration to really bedevil and cripple his policy. And so the October 1983 terrorist bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut is emblematic of that. You know, we won't go into all the details there, but the gist of it is Reagan's administration was very divided. The Pentagon didn't want to have Marine peacekeepers in Beirut. The State Department did. Reagan kind of split the difference by sending the Marine peacekeepers there, but with a very circumscribed mission where they weren't really able to keep the peace. And so effectively that made them sitting ducks for a terrorist attack. And so Iranian-sponsored terrorists bombed the barracks and 241 Marines are killed. It's a horrible tragedy. It's the worst single-day loss of life for the Marine Corps since Iwo Jima, you know, almost 40 years earlier. But it's also a catastrophic policy and leadership failure on the part of Reagan that he had put them there in the first place. And again, it's not clear what the exact right policy would have been, but we know that the Reagan one was the wrong policy, right? Essentially, the two options would have been either really be there in force and have a more vigorous mandate and resourcing to really keep the peace or impose a peace. Okay, that's one possibility. Or just don't be there at all, right? And just realize that this is a civil war. It's awful, but we cannot solve it other than, you know, maybe help convene some diplomacy. But instead, he kind of picked the worst possible option, and there was a horrible price to pay for that.
You also place a particular emphasis on Reagan's engagement with Asia.
Yes.
And that's partially economic, Japan being sort of the second power of this of the 1980s, but it's also strategic.
Yeah.
Like it's a really important strategic partnership, and as uncomfortable as it is to say, as a Brit, Reagan very much views Japan as its most important ally,
yes,
not the UK.
Yes, yes. His closest personal friend in office is Margaret Thatcher, right? So our British listeners, don't worry. You know, the Iron Lady gets her due, and she really is, you know, very important to Reagan. And the special relationship is, you know, it's part of its heyday. But fundamentally, Reagan often calls the U.S.-Japan relationship the most important bilateral relationship in the world. And this is where earlier I was being, I think, justifiably critical of his Middle East policy. Here's where I will say that in addition to the peaceful victory in the Cold War, I think Reagan's second most important foreign policy legacy is in Asia, and in a very successful way. When he comes into office, his three predecessors, Nixon, Ford, and Carter, had all really pursued a China-first policy in Asia. They thought that China was the key to the future of the U.S. posture and U.S. interests in Asia. Reagan disagreed. He wasn't hostile to China. He knew that they were an important partner for containing the Soviet Union. But Reagan and his Secretary of State, George Shultz, they had a Japan-first vision. They thought that Japan was the more important American partner and ally in Asia, not China. And yet they had a problem. Most Americans saw Japan as primarily an economic rival, right? This was, you know, Japan was on its way becoming the second, third largest economy in the world, depending on how we measure these things. And, you know, an incredible economic success story, but it was also meaning massive losses of American manufacturing jobs. Japan was exporting a lot of its goods, consumer electronics, automobiles to the United States, but Japan's trade barriers were preventing American goods from being exported there. It was a massive problem. And Reagan knew he needed to address those economic challenges, but he had more of a strategic vision that he wanted to transform the U.S.-Japan relationship from primarily an economic rivalry to primarily a strategic partnership. And at the time, Japan was the only democracy in Asia also. And so there's a values component to this too. And so, you know, two of the key prongs of Reagan's Asia strategy were first, like I said, upgrade the U.S.-Japan relationship, get Japan to spend more on its military to ease the defense burden in the United States. And they do that. Nakasone, the Japanese prime minister, essentially triples Japan's defense spending at this time. But also, as part of that, Reagan avoids an out-and-out trade war with Japan. He does some, you know, short-term tariff measures. But in the bigger picture, he's very anti-protectionist. He's committed to an open trading order. And then he also wants to expand the number of democracies in the Asia Pacific. And the United States had allies such as South Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, which were military dictatorships. You know, they're anti-communists who are partnered with them, but they're not fellow democracies. And Reagan keeps those alliances with them, but also strongly encourages, through diplomacy and, you know, some quiet coercive measures, peaceful transitions to democracy in all three of those countries. States. And so by the time he's leaving office, you have a new wave of democracies in the Asia Pacific. You have reduced trade tensions, and you have a restored U.S. relationship with Japan. The one thing Reagan's very committed to is Taiwan's security too. You know, he was under pressure from Nixon, Kissinger, others to essentially hand Taiwan back to China as part of a grand bargain. And Reagan says, no, we'll cooperate with China on some things, but Taiwan is also an important partner of ours. We're going to stand by them. This helps midwife Taiwanese democracy, but it's also where you get some of the roots of the American security commitment to Taiwan, of providing Taiwan enough weapons to defend itself, and Reagan pressing China to reiterate its commitment to peaceful resolution of cross-strait differences. You know, in the year 2024, we're now recording that, there's renewed concerns about China's commitment to peaceful resolution, but in a lot of ways, we can at least in part thank Reagan for the fact that Taiwan is still not controlled by the Chinese Communist Party.
I mean, the book is commendably subtle on trying to build lessons out of it. You sort of leave them for the reader to interpret them. Mm. So what motivated you to present it that way? Because obviously it's difficult not to read this book in light of contemporary U.S. foreign policy, the modern Republican Party.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that because I wrestled with that a lot. You know, over the several years I was researching and writing the book, you've got the rise of Donald Trump and, you know, the American Republican Party moving in some, you know, different directions, if you will, than the Reagan-esque tradition. But I'll say I'm someone who's very committed to the Applied History Project, right? As you know, I've written elsewhere on this. You and I have talked about this a lot. Mm-hmm. So I do believe in the policy relevance of history and so on and so forth. But I also believe that we need to keep some distinctions clear. And a lot of times the best history is history that is written and can stand on its own, okay? And I worried that if I were to do a concluding chapter of in the book of here's lessons from Reagan for today, or if I were to conclude with some sort of Jeremiah against Trump and the Republican Party today, it would just make the book feel dated, right? At the risk of immodesty, I hope that 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, people will still want to read this book as a faithful and interesting history. And rather than this book being a snapshot of internecine Republican squabbles in the years 2023 and 24, or a template for how the U.S. should manage the China competition today or something. So now in other contexts, in op-eds or the occasional podcast interview, yeah, I'll share what some of my reflections might be on that now. But I thought it might have undermined or tainted the book a little bit if I were to have packaged that into the book itself. And also, I want to reach a broad audience. A number of fans of Trump and supporters of Trump have read the book and also enjoyed it as a good history and not felt like Inboden was using it to flagellate them over their support for Trump. So I think a good history within the covers, the pages of the book can stand on its own.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Will. The book is The Peacemaker, Ronald Reagan, the Cold War and the World on the Brink. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Angus. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to EI Talks. The producer is Alistair Benn, and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones. Until next time, thank you.